Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova. Hey, and welcome back to the Future Thinkers podcast. It's been a while since we've released an episode. About 2 months ago, we actually had to move back to Canada after 4 years living in Bulgaria because of the whole pandemic thing. It was pretty fun. We had to pack 11 suitcases and a four-month-old onto the plane just as the last flights were shutting down. So it was a bit of a stressful, crazy event. But we're back, and being back has actually been really great. We've been able to make a lot of progress on our retreat center project, so except now it's going to be happening in British Columbia instead of Bulgaria. And it's become really clear to us that this is the right place for us to build it and that we're going to go forward with it here. So if you guys are listening to this and you're living in British Columbia or you have connections there and you want to get involved, you want to help us make this happen, if you want to learn more, well, first of all, you can check out the vision at futurethinkers.org/center. And if you want to get a hold of us, you can email us at futurethinkerspodcast@gmail.com. We're currently looking for investors, advisors, and other community members who want to help us bring this vision into reality. So we've got our eye on a few properties right now, but if you know of a recreational acreage in British Columbia that might be listed soon and we just have to see it, then send us an email.
Another new thing that's happening is that recently we've started hosting guest-facilitated workshops in our members area. So last month we had Chris Beasley do one on overcoming our drive to constantly be busy. It was quite deep and intense and kind of knocked the socks off a bunch of our participants. If you missed it, you can still get access to the recording by becoming a member. It's available to basic and premium members now. So this month, we've got a workshop coming up by John Verveke. It'll be on finding your center, your root, and your focus in meditation. And that starts on June 16th. And starting on July 14th, we've got a workshop by Michael Taft on generating archetypal mind states with the purpose of becoming more effective, compassionate, and more awake. And both of these are available to our basic and premium members. You can find more info and sign up for them at futurethinkers.org/events. Okay, now for the podcast episode.
With this episode, we're starting a podcast series about regenerative village design, where we are featuring notable people in the areas of regenerative cultures, self-sustaining communities, and smart villages. Our first guest in this series is James Ehrlich, the founder of Regen Villages, a Stanford University spin-off company creating the so-called Tesla of eco-villages. In this episode, we talk about designing smart villages, why this is what communities of the future will look like, and what are the barriers and risks to getting there. You can find all the show notes and links at futurethinkers.org/124. And to get access to the full interview, just sign up to become a member at members.futurethinkers.org. And if you know of an expert we should feature in the Regenerative Smart Villages series, please let us know on Twitter at futurethinkers_. Now let's get into the show. So James, welcome. Thank you for joining us in this conversation. We have been doing a ton of research for the last few years about regenerative villages and retreat centers. And we were connected to you by, I think it was Joshua Hughes, right? Mm-hmm. From We Are Black Sheep. And you came with a lot of praise from him. And we're excited to talk to you about your experience and about the software you're working on to kind of reimagine how we're going to look at designing smart villages. So I think the first question I want to ask here is, what needs to change out there in the world? And what is the need that has been created for what you are doing?
Well, I was inspired in a lot of ways in my research for Regen Villages at Stanford University, which was, you know, born as a research initiative that I brought sort of into Stanford from my previous experience with organic, biodynamic, family farm, case study research, and also intentional community, eco-villages, co-housing, collaborative information. And in 2012, I think, there was a Rockefeller Foundation research report that was really eye-opening because essentially had said that up until 1950, 75% of planet Earth's human population lived in self-sustaining small communities. Mm-hmm. And that from 1950 until projected 2050, that the opposite was going to happen, that nearly 75% of 10 billion people would be living in these coastal megacities. And And I found that to be kind of a terrifying concept, because I grew up in New York City. I grew up in Manhattan, and it's a lovely place. It's a very thankful place to be if you want a particular kind of rural regional Indian food delivered at 3:30 in the morning. That can happen if you've got money. But it's also a very brittle place. And when things break in a city environment, they typically break very badly and for a lot of people. And it's very difficult to bring those systems back online. So I felt pretty compelled that the best case for our species living in flourishing, thriving ways going forward for the next, hopefully, n number of thousands of years, is actually to spread back out of cities, at least a certain percentage of the population, to be able to have the safety and security of strong, regenerative, resilient neighborhood complexes. And then that also paralleled the UN research, which came out in 2013, that basically said the best way to feed 10 billion people is not through big ag. It's actually through a small, hyper-local organic farms that restore biodiversity and create this kind of patchwork of, again, localized resiliency. So I was predictive of regen villages and this exodus from cities, but my predictive modeling was more based on climate change anomalies and also economic inequality.
Hard to predict the whole pandemic thing and the increase of desire to go out to these eco villages just based off of the isolation and job loss in urban environments. It's
and tough. The authoritarianism.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, we've seen such a rise just as kind of a receiving ground at Future Thinkers of interest in these topics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I try to stay out of that fray as much as possible, and look more towards optimistic solutions. Because I really feel like that's the thing that people crave the most. People need hope, and they need guidance towards that hope. So that's really the focus that I've had for a long time in my life, because I've seen what's possible. Hey, I've seen these kinds of barren, desertified areas that have been restored and brought back to these sort of oases of blossoming, fruiting, thriving areas that support humanity. So I know that's what's possible.
Can you give some examples of that? Actually, that's a kind of a great place to start here. We've heard stories of that as well, and it's so encouraging.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories, and I have it in my presentation, is about an eco-village in southern India called Auroville. It's about 100 kilometers south of Chennai. And in the mid-1970s, a small group of people came together as part of a group underwritten in some ways by a global eco-village network, GEN. And they were inspired about creating a spiritual community, but also a community that could be self-sustaining. And in the course of, from the mid-1970s until today, they have restored approximately 2,500 circular hectare of land from desert into lush greenery that has become its own microclimate. Wow. It brings its own rain. They have 3,000 full-time residents. They entertain over 500,000 visitors each year. And they're capable of feeding people, hydrating people, empowering them with renewable energy, and digesting waste. So it's a low-tech solution, but it proves that over a period of n number of years, that you can create these circumstances for restoration that then provides critical life support for people who live in those areas. So, and there's really a lot of examples of this. There's another example from India of one person, one man, who spent 29 years by himself walking into this place that had been denuded of trees And over 29 years, he just started planting by himself, just planting trees there. In 29 years, he has restored 550 hectare, which is an area, I mean, it's unimaginable, but essentially, again, it's a microclimate. It brought the water and restorative, kind of capability for aquifers again. And elephants came and tigers came and the monkeys came and the birds came and the pollinators came. And he created a lush forest that is now in benefit and service to the local villages, because now they have, you know, these restored aquifers and they have nutrition that they can gain from, you know, from the forest. So there's a lot of examples where an individual can make a huge difference over a period of time. Now, imagine if you brought enough people together, focusing on these sort of lily pads of self-sustaining communities, then we could get to a place where we kind of used to be on planet Earth, where we had what we needed, but also we actually overproduced certain things. And that's what created sort of new economic models, because we could then go to the town square, to the piazza, and barter and trade and sell our surplus for things that we didn't have or that we weren't cultivating.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've heard several stories in the East of this happening, but not so much in the West. And I'm wondering if there's kind of an issue with the way our society is set up, or the fact that there are a lot of projects taking the kind of individual grassroots approach, but there's not really a huge industrial movement. Can you speak to that a bit?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think really what it comes down to is at the end of the day, there are powerful forces that have control, and they're either landowners, they're district scale utilities, pretty much locked in to pre-existing economic models. It's material companies. It's folks who are used to the pre-industrial model or industrial model of pre-COVID, let's say, of rinse and repeat real estate development. And so the idea of looking at a piece of land, let's say you're looking at 50, 60 acre parcel of land, instead of looking at taking two-thirds of that land grant and making it a permaculture flourishing life support system for the 20 acres that is for density for housing, that instead what they do is they look at the full 60 acres to put as much housing as they possibly can on every square foot or every square meter that they possibly can, and maximize greed, essentially. Now, I understand there's a housing crisis, and I understand we have to find more housing for people, but we have to do it in a way that it works within nature, not separate from it. And I think we're really suffering from that a great deal in the West, and our culture in the West has a long way to kind of come back to how things used to be.
This is, I think, something that's becoming really, really evident right now as supply chains are starting to falter and, you know, food is getting really expensive in certain parts, or shelves are empty in other parts, because the supply chains are very global and they're optimized for that, you know, cost-effective mass production, but they're also brittle. And how do we redesign things on a more global how do we redesign things on a more local level? What do you think are the components, and at what scale do they have to be put in?
Well, I'd like to think that over the course of the last 4.5 years or so, with the popularity of regen villages, especially in the media, that we've helped to inspire a number of developers to think differently. Particularly, you see in the U.S. now, a nice movement towards what are called agrihoods. So you see these ideas of combined residential living with some adjacency or access to an organic farm. And it's not necessarily the full integration, of course, that we talk about with regen villages, but at least it's a start. So that's how we can begin to make that kind of relationship with nature. And I really believe that the world has woken up because of COVID on this realization that the globalized food network for getting nutrition is incredibly brittle. And especially now where governments are basically saying, we're a little nervous about sharing, you know, our food supply with the rest of the world. We really want to keep that kind of here to feed our own people, to maintain civilization security. And when they do that, of course, it creates ripple effects across the whole established globalized distribution framework, where then everybody starts to get nervous and anxious. And then all of a sudden you start to see these things you thought you would never see in this grand world that we've built, which are called empty shelves and hoarding. And so at least by us here in Silicon Valley, next to Stanford University, I'm starting to see almost on every front lawn and backyards, the farm gardens going up, the victory gardens. People are building chicken coops. They're looking at all different kinds of ways to grow different things and be in a little bit of a network with their neighbors, of growing different things to share with each other. So that's happening right now because of COVID and because of people like ourselves and my family. If we're lucky, we get about maybe 50-60% of our food basket because of things that are just missing because people have been shopping for it and putting it in their freezers or whatever it is. So there's been a lot of that going on. So yeah, we know that there's now an opportunity to create these communities and to spur the master planning around food and the master planning around clean water and clean energy and waste to resource management. It's not just one piece like energy or water or waste. It's the full basket of critical life support. And then you bring in, you know, the energy positive homes that layer on top of that master plan. And then essentially over a period of a few years into the community, things start to really blossom and fruit. And certainly over a period of by year one to year, let's say seven, a lot of those systems become essentially symbiotic naturally in ecosystems. So you get the right kind of pollinators coming at the right time, the right predators for the pests coming at the right time. All of that is because you're broadcasting these natural signals out into the world. So that can only happen if you're really focusing on the full gestalt ecosystem. So that's kind of the tipping point that will happen for these communities.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
You know, this feels like when the first smartphone came out and people, I was one of the first ones to pre-order it into Canada before they were even selling it there. And I received it and I had this feeling of like, this is the future. Everyone's going to be using this in a few years. And I'm getting that same feeling with this, like this is going to be the way to live for everyone.
It may not be for everyone. Yeah.
But not a forcing thing. It's going to be a thing. Yeah. Like you can choose to live in cities and
right.
do it the way you've always done. But this is like the kind of new smartphone or Tesla or something like that. Like, you're going to want to be in this kind of environment.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no doubt about it that, look, people thought I was certifiable 6 years ago, including esteemed colleagues at Stanford and Singularity and other places, where they just said, gosh, you must be inept because you can't even see the trend from 1950 to today of hundreds of millions of people or billions of people moving to cities. Like, what's wrong with you that you think somehow or another that you're going to, you know, reverse that trend? And I said, it's not me that's going to reverse the trend. It's going to be some things that happen that's going to reverse that trend. And we need to be prepared for when cities want to start to vent or empty some portion of their populations. And that's exactly what's happened in the last 2 months. You've had entire urban areas, the wealthy folks, let's say from Manhattan, they went to the Hamptons, they went to upstate New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, wherever they had second homes, and because they could, or they got on their private jet and they went someplace else where they had a private home or a bunker, who knows what they have. And then, you know, addition to that, you had a lot of young people who just kind of said, okay, let's just go find someplace to go. And also in Europe, you know, you had, as soon as France had announced that, you know, that Paris was going into a lockdown, you had this exodus of people trying to get to the provincial areas. And those rural areas, they don't have the capability to welcome those people as much as they were trying to welcome them over the last decades and bring them back out. They don't have the ability to really house them and feed them and provide medical care. So this has been a really eye-opening experience the last 2 months. That I agree with you that it's beyond a sort of a shiny iPhone. It's really now about safety and self-preservation, and then of course, you know, ideally having hope that you can live someplace where, you know, you have a path to ownership. And also, I think also the critical thing that's happened because of COVID is about work, and that employers now realize that they can actually have a good portion of their workforce not in an office and working from remote locations. And that's going to be some huge epiphanies coming very soon about commercial space in these big cities. And so, to be honest, I think the retrofits we're going to see for these office buildings are that they're going to become probably some kind of more residential, co-living, co-working spaces.
I love that.
Because
I hope you're right.
They're going to have to figure out a way to do something with those structures.
Mm-hmm. What, in your experience, do you feel are some of the most unexpected benefits for people in moving into this kind of village?
Well, my current affiliation at Stanford University is in the School of Medicine as part of a group called Stanford Flourishing. And the key driver for me, for Regen Villages, is and has always been and will continue to be about happy, healthy longevity, that people can live very calm, peaceful, healthy, happy lives, and that the communities are visceral in that way, from babies being born in the community to life celebrations happening, birthdays, anniversaries, graduations, whatever it may be, to people, you know, finding new economic models and inspirations of self-worth as opposed to work or their title, but real self-worth. And then as people mature and get older, that wisdom is something that should really be respected and understood to impart back to the children. Most importantly, that as a child growing up, in a village, like a regen village, you see where you belong in that story arc of life. That you know as you get older, you are your knowledge and your wisdom is revered and is interesting and important. And that's where we've really lost our way, I think, as a species, to imagine that if you have a baby, you're a pariah, and if you get to a certain age, you're garbage. And that's essentially what we've been telling people, that there's this sort of sweet spot of, you know, between 20-something and 40-something, and everything else is really peripheral. And that's a big mistake. So this ecosystem, sociologically, anthropologically, psychologically, these are not communities that have social engineering. They're mainly intended for multi-generational, multicultural, and most importantly, socioeconomic level difference communities that can come together in these locations where it doesn't matter if you're in a social affordable apartment or you are in a villa, or if you are from another country or another part of the world, or that you're young or that you're old. Food is the great disarming for that. Recipes or stories. And that's my background, is when you're eating healthy, delicious things and you're laughing and you're telling stories, it just removes all these barriers between people that have been created, you know, as illusions that somehow we have all these differences with each other, and we really don't. At the end of the day, people want their kids to grow up healthy and strong and have meaningful lives and have hope for their children and children after that. And people want to grow older with dignity. I think that's pretty much the human experience, I could say. What ambitions, at least. So That's the new wealth, put it that way.
What do you see are some of the barriers to making this vision a reality?
Well, you know, you can see the brick marks on my forehead, probably, because of the fact that, you know, being an entrepreneur, you know, Elon Musk, he says it really well, you know, it's like eating glass every day. I add to that, it's like being on this roller coaster where, you know, the teenage kid who was running the roller coaster didn't really strap me in very well. So with every turn and every curve, I'm just literally like flying out of this roller coaster. And for some reason I keep getting back on and I keep riding it. So the barriers are many, because of the fact that there's greed. And I think that's the kind of the heart of the issue, is that there's a current kind of concept around needing to maximize profits always over the benefit of public goodwill. And I'm not talking about communism and I'm not talking about socialism. I sort of extol the virtues of something called compassionism, where you can have profit and it can be an impact kind of profit, but it's shaving some number of percentage points off of that and also extending the number of years that you get that profit kind of back out, sufficient for enough, hopefully, to reinvest in other kinds of impact investments. So that's really the mechanism. It's this new kind of philanthropy, which is not just giving and walking away and expecting some glossy, you know, kind of report at the end of the year with metrics and graphs, but actually that there's an impact return to that philanthropy, which then is again recedes that aquifer, and then that liquidity can go back out to other impact groups. So in terms of barriers, I mean, I like to say that it's not a matter of technology; it's a matter of money and political will. And when you look at the political will, it a lot of times operates around money, and those industrial forces. For instance, the rules on the books to build a neighborhood, to build a subdivision, those rules were put on the books 100, 150 years ago. I like to say mostly by old white guys in top hats with these long white beards.
The Monopoly because, guys.
Well, yeah, because they owned district scale water and power and sewage and of course big ag and all these different things. They have this need to create and perpetuate dependency on their systems, and that is baked into the laws and the rules of zoning and permitting. There's no good reason. It's not a matter of physics. There's no good reason that you can't get a piece of land, do all the right permaculture planning, do all the right kinds of thought process for the right balance of people living in those communities in relationship with that nature, and be able to go from master plan to move in 6 to 8 months using prefab, manufactured components, wall units, modules, etc. All the technology is there to live in these very beautiful, self-sustaining communities, but the rules have to change. So that's a huge barrier where we hope our software, actually, the village operating system software, as a tool for modeling these new regenerative, resilient neighborhoods, can come to play as kind of a golden key to unlock those, a new rule book, basically. But also that the software, once it's done modeling and creating the blueprints for that community, that software also is what is used to actually run the regenerative infrastructure for that neighborhood. So there's a tremendous value for developers and constructors and municipalities to create these kinds of communities. Another big barrier, and I believe this to be true, and I also believe the software will solve, is that governments are afraid, for some reason, of decentralized communities because they fear that people will maybe rise up and say, I don't want to pay taxes. Why should I if I'm not connected to district scale managed services? Why should we have to pay into a system in that way? Well, that's the reason also when the municipality and the regional and the national governments and the funds and others are using our software to help create this new rule book, that's the basis then of establishing this long-term positive relationship. So they don't lose tax base, in other words. But also that we can look at creating these communities with new opportunity zone tax structures. So if you move to a community like this, you get a benefit. If you start a business in a community like this, wow, you get another big benefit. If you hire and employ people as part of that new business in that regenerative resilient community, then you even get more benefits. So, and that's really where we have to think these days in terms of breaking down, those barriers. So there's no shortage of them. We just have to be creative in making a new model, as Buckminster Fuller used to say, make a new model that makes the older models obsolete, where those players then want to join and be part of that because that's where they see their future profits coming from.
As an entrepreneur, I've found that the philosophy seek forgiveness, not permission, has worked out quite well for me. Is there a place for that here?
Yes and no. Because you traditional rules and regulations are, considered like handed down from the Almighty. It's himself, like here's this zoning book. And, and the bureaucrats aren't bad people. They're good people. And they want to see, regen villages get built. But when they open the rule book and it says, we can't change that rule because that rule is on the books. Well, that's the thing is you can't just build something and then ask for permission or apologize later. You need to kind of front load and start to change those rules, earlier on. And that's what we're doing now. And I think we've made a lot of progress with that. It's also, you know, the floodgate, they can't control it anymore. You've got this exodus of people coming from cities, and they desperately need new build subdivisions where they're not going to put their money in to traditional build. Yeah. They're not going to put their money and buy or rent in traditional car culture subdivision developments. They're demanding for, you know, the ability to have access and agency to food and water and clean energy and waste to resource management. They're demanding these things. So we're, you know, Regen Villages is really perfectly positioned to answer the pain points of those landowners and those local governments and also industry to be geared up to deliver these kinds of communities rapidly. Mm-hmm. And I really get excited about what's possible for the Global South, that in rural India, sub-Saharan Africa, across ASEAN, even, you know, here, rural America and Canada, places that are really hurting, that that people on a social or barely affordable kind of budget can have access to housing, not as a privilege, but as a right, and have agency with natural resources, not as a luxury, but as a right. So yeah, I mean, I really feel like we can make that business model happen for the bottom of the pyramid, but then you really need the systemic funding from governments to support that. And with social housing, especially, there has to be some kind of path to ownership, that as people work and live and do things in the community, they're essentially paying down a mortgage. So 20 years in, they can actually give this property, you know, to their kids, et cetera. So I'm excited about these ideas. And now looking at what's happening with what's called the green transition coming out of Europe and the EU, Canada, you know, Trudeau has made announcements. You've got South Korea, New Zealand. And what does that mean? It's a green transition for a post-COVID optimistic future, investing trillions, really, in new green infrastructure. And what that is inclusive of is especially housing and localized resiliency. So, I mean, again, we're kind of perfectly situated with our software and our vision and our plans to help inoculate these kinds of self-reliant neighborhoods at scale around the world.
I think this is actually a good place to kind of wrap up the audio portion of this episode and do a second one where we dive into the presentation for the software.
Sure.
We don't usually do this. We don't usually go into like the kind of offerings and businesses of the people we interview, but we've already discussed this before. And I found this software to be so interesting that like, I feel we have to do this. It's just unbelievable. So if you guys are listening, I forget what episode number this is, but we'll put that in the outro. And then get on video, get in on YouTube, futurethinkers.org/YouTube, I think. We'll mm-hmm. forward you to the YouTube channel. And then check this video out because this is going to be really interesting.
All right, that was James Ehrlich from Regen Villages. To find all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/124. And to access the full video episode, just become a member at members.futurethinkers.org. And if you're interested in learning more and getting involved in our Retreat Center project, go to futurethinkers.org/center. And to sign up for upcoming workshops, go to futurethinkers.org/events. See you in the next episode.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.